Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
Hello and welcome once more to the program. I'm happy you've tuned in and hope you'll get some benefit out of what we discuss today. Our discussions are based on the mind training text, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, by the Tibetan teacher Namgyal Pal. And we've come to a section of the text that presents a number of slogans that we can use to help us deal positively with situations that come up in our day-to-day lives. The slogans often appear quite obscure, like avoid poisonous food, don't maintain inverted loyalty, and don't strike at the vital point. But once we get into them, we see that they make good sense. The slogan we were discussing last week was, don't sprint to win the race, or don't make a race, or don't try to be the fastest. And we've seen that this has various meanings. It can mean don't approach your spiritual practice as if it were a buggy on a racetrack, going like crazy to win the race. Gyan Trungpa comments on this in Training the Mind and Cultivating Loving Kindness, using the translation, don't try to be the fastest. When practitioners begin to develop their understanding of the teaching of the Dharma and their appreciation of the Dharma, they sometimes fall into a sort of racehorse approach, he says. Such practitioners are concerned with who can do their prostrations faster, who can sit better, who can eat better, who can do this and that better. But if our practice is regarded purely as a race, we have a problem. The whole thing has become a game rather than an actual practice, and there's no seed of benevolence and gentleness in the practitioner. So you should not use your practice as a way to get ahead of your fellow students. And Jamyang Kuntral says something very similar in The Great Path of Awakening, an easily accessible introduction for ordinary people. The slogan in his book is, don't aim to win, and he writes, in a horse race, the aim is to be the fastest. Among Dharma people, there are often hopes of receiving more attention or being more highly regarded than others, and little schemes are made up to find ways to acquire possessions. Give these up. Have no concern about receiving or not receiving recognition or prestige. The slogan can also mean that we shouldn't always be looking out for the best for ourselves, the best piece of cake, the best seat in the theater, or even at a spiritual teaching, and so on, leaving what is not so good for others. Don't bring competitiveness into the spiritual path is another explanation of it, and another tells us not to make a spurt at the end of a project so that we seem to have done most of the work and can claim most of the credit. From all this, we can see that these slogans can instruct and advise us about many related aspects of our behavior. But now, before going any further, let's bring to mind our motivation as we usually do and make sure it's as vast as possible. As I've said many times before, bodhicitta, the intention to achieve enlightenment to best benefit all living beings, is the most vast motivation, as its object, all living beings, is so vast. There are countless living beings, and so the wish to help all of them without bias is a very great wish that brings great positive potential. So let that be our motivation. But if it seems too much of a task for you, please motivate for your own enlightenment and liberation from suffering. Thank you. Now, while looking at the slogan, don't sprint to win the race, we saw one of the meanings is not to take the credit for other people's work. As you may remember, B. Alan Wallace commented, we should not be like a person who, for most of the time, works with someone else to accomplish a task, but near the finish shows exaggerated zeal in order to receive alone full credit for the work. This would be like two soldiers having jointly defeated the enemy, but one pretending to be the sole hero of the battle in order to collect the medals and promotion for himself alone. Okay, so we should not behave like that. But then the question arises, what about when someone else does that to me? After all, it's common for ordinary worldly people to figuratively stab each other in the back to climb this corporate or social ladder. We know not to do that to others, But what should we do when someone else does that to us? An enlightened being would, of course, not care who the credit goes to. But we are mostly a long way from there, and unless we're making patience a particular practice, we may well need due recognition to keep us going. Also, progress in the everyday world does depend on recognition of good work done, so it's a good idea to know how to make sure that we are not taken advantage of. Another and probably the most important point is that it's not good karma for someone to take credit for others' work. It involves deceit and lies, and so caring for them, we may have to stop the behavior, perhaps by making it clear everything they claim does not belong to them. In any case, Amy Gallo addresses the question in an article titled How to Respond When Someone Takes Credit for Your Work in the Harvard Business Review. She's a contributing editor at the Harvard Business Review and is the author of The HBR Guide to Dealing with Conflict. So, of course, the article looks at what may happen at work, but I think we can adapt her principles to any situation. This is what she says. There's nothing more infuriating than someone taking credit for your work. We've all had this happen at one point or another. You share an idea with a colleague and then hear him repeat it in a meeting. You stay late to finish a presentation, yet your team member accepts all the praise. You lead a long overdue project to completion, and your boss tells the higher-ups it was his doing. How should you handle these situations? Is it okay to speak up right there and then, or should you keep quiet? And how can you make sure that you get the credit you deserve in the future? She then visits a couple of experts on the subject and says, "We want to believe that our work speaks for itself, but in the real world, it matters who gets the credit," says Karen Dillon, author of the HBR Guide to Office Politics. "That all goes into the bank account of how much value you bring to the organization and plays into promotion decisions, raises, and assignments. And you can't assume that people will notice the time and effort you put in," says Brian Uzi, professor of leadership and organizational change at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management, and author of the HBR article, Make Your Enemies Your Allies. "With collaborative work, it's not always clear who has done what," he says, which leaves the door open for a colleague to take undue credit. Amy Gallo then lists some things to do when someone tries to claim your work or ideas as their own. First, she says, take time to calm down. She writes, "You may be tempted to call the person out right away, but Uzi says this is a big, big mistake. There's no sense in making a scene in a meeting or confronting your colleague in the hallway. You look petulant, like a kid who's folded her arms and is pouting," says Dillon. "Plus, if you're emotionally piqued at being ripped off, it's not the time to talk about it. Neurologically, your mind is not working at its best, and you may get out-argued," says Uzi. "Take a day or two to calm down, but don't stew about it for so long that by the time you talk to the person, you're ready to explode. You also want to make sure the incident is still fresh in everyone's mind." The next point is to assess the severity of the situation. Gallo says, "Most people jump to conclusions and think right away, they're trying to make me look bad, or they're only interested in making themselves look good," explains Dillon. "But more often than not, it's just an oversight. I see it with my students all the time," says Uzi. "During a presentation, they intend to say we, but then under pressure they freeze and end up using I the whole time. Consider the possibility that your credit-stealing colleague's behavior might be unintentional, or it might be not as egregious as you initially thought. Perhaps you remember that your boss did mention your name a few times during the presentation, or recognize that your colleague was combining your brilliant idea with his. Uzi suggests writing down what you would say to the person if you were to talk to her. Let that sit and then go back and look at it again. Ask yourself, how much does this really matter? Will it negatively impact on my career? Not every piece of work has to have your name on it, and managers often take credit for the work of their subordinates. Making your boss shine is part of the gig, Dylan explains. You may not get credit for the idea or for slaving over the analysis, but hopefully your boss absorbs that you're an important part of her team. Then Agallo asks us to ask why. Instead of making accusations, ask questions. This shifts the burden of proof to your colleague. He has to explain why he felt justified taking credit for the project or idea. Research shows that it's much better to ask why it happened than to make a claim, says Uzi. You say something like, how did you feel the presentation went? Did you feel like you were able to hit all the main points? Some might see this strategy as passive-aggressive, but it will give your colleague an opportunity to recognize his mistake. If that doesn't happen, you can say something along the lines of, I noticed that when you talked about the project, you said I instead of we. Was that intentional? Why did you present it that way? Dylan says that your goal isn't to pin the blame, but to show them that you noticed and that you didn't think it was right. The next point is remedy the situation. If the credit stealer acknowledges his mistake, talk about how you can make things right, Gallo says. Perhaps he can email the group thanking you for your contributions, or you can both go talk to your manager to set the record straight. Even if he's not willing to do anything, you can take action. Use any opportunity to demonstrate your involvement with a project. Whenever the project or idea is talked about, in person or via email, chime in with details or answers, says Dylan, to prove your knowledge. And consider asking others for help. It can be uncomfortable to toot your own horn, so find a third person who understands your contributions and can speak on your behalf in a meeting or when the project comes up in conversation. You might approach your colleague and say, I worked really hard on this report, but sometimes I find it hard to promote my own work. I would appreciate it if you asked me questions about it in the meeting. Then in the meeting, this person can ask you and your colleague questions, such as, when you two were thinking about these ideas, how did you approach this issue? This provides others with social proof of your work, says Uzi. It plants in everybody's mind who was actually responsible. What happens when none of this works and you still feel you have been the victim of credit theft? Karen Dillon suggests talking to your boss or another manager who can do something about it. But, she says, be careful not to come off as a complainer. She says, frame it as an effort to create a good working relationship, not a way to badmouth your colleague. Your boss wants you to be able to work well together. She isn't going to want to come in and separate the children. And then do what has to be done to stop it happening again. Gallo writes, Uzi's research shows that in collaborative projects, it's important to agree upfront on how credit would be allocated. Who will present these ideas to the senior team? Who will field questions? Who will send the email to the rest of the company? At the same time, people need to be able to revisit these agreements if the expected proportion of contributions changes, says Uzi. So be flexible. Dylan suggests creating a chart of who's going to do what. Write it down and keep it in the email, she says. Gallo's final point is model good credit sharing. And she writes, if you're generous and intentional about sharing credit, others are likely to follow suit. Never hesitate to ask your team, what's the best way to make sure all of our work is recognized? Uzi says that he used to add a slide at the end of his presentations with the name of everyone who had contributed to the research. But I was rushed and didn't always get to the last slide, he says. Now, he gives his collaborators the deck beforehand and asks, what do you think? Does it give appropriate credit? At the same time, don't go overboard and thank everyone who worked on any little part of the project. In an attempt to cover everybody, you devalue the contribution. Focus your recognition on the people who truly deserve it. Amy Gallo then gives two case studies as illustrations. The names have been changed, of course, And the first study, which he titles Make Your Contributions Visible, involves Carl Simons, a man who, and I quote, split his time between his infantry unit and his human resources department. Part of his job was to review draft assessments for all senior leaders in his formation. While looking over the paperwork, he noticed that his commanding officer had taken credit for one of his ideas. Kyle had developed a time-saving report for teams to document their work, which fulfilled a formal requirement from senior commanders. The report helps us avoid duplicating efforts, Kyle explains. This was noted as an accomplishment on the CO's annual assessment. But I was given no such credit on my review, Kyle says. He sat on this information for a few days, but after thinking it through, he decided he should speak up for himself. Kyle went to the CO and asked him why he'd taken credit for the reporting change. The CO seemed a bit taken aback, but mostly he was indifferent and acted like it didn't matter who got the credit, he says. Kyle found the response odd, since the CO was always quick to ensure people knew what he did and became quite petulant if he didn't get the credit for his efforts. From that point on, Kyle made sure to send copies to others when he responded to his CO's requests for input. And if it was a project that included units beyond my own, I blind copied superiors I knew in the chain of command, he explains. I had to protect my contributions. This nipped the behavior in the bud, because the CO could no longer take credit when others knew better. Kyle treats his own subordinates differently as a result of this experience. It's amazing to see how engaged people become when they're recognized, he says. Owen Collins, the director and teacher at a small college, features in the next case study, which Gallo titles Enlist Others Who Can Stand Up For You. She writes, after the birth of his second child, Collins decided to take a semester's paternity leave. Although he and his boss had hoped to delay an important departmental review until his return, it couldn't be put off, and so it fell to the professor who was filling in for Owen, and we'll call her Clarissa. She called me completely stressed out, he recalls. So he spent several hours on the phone with her, explaining what needed to be done and agreeing to help. On the call, I signed up to do 3/4 of the work, but I could tell right away that there was going to be problems with who would get the credit for what, he explains. She wanted everything to go through her, and was already saying things like, my report, and all the legwork I need to get done. Owen suggested that he and other people working on the report meet in person to go over the review before handing it in to the department chair. When they did, Clarissa Bay began by representing the drafts as hers. But Owen took every opportunity to demonstrate his critical contributions, fielding questions, and providing key information. I didn't want to accuse her because I knew she would get defensive, but it was clear to everyone in the room that I'd done the lion's share of the work, he says. Clarissa seemed to recognize that she needed to share credit for the review, and Owen knew that although he couldn't attend the meeting where the team formally presented it to the department chair, he now had allies who would speak up on his behalf. And that is Amy Gallo. And one of her points, she says that often we make the whole thing personal and jump to the conclusion that the person who took the credit is trying to make us look bad and themselves look good. But she explains that may not be the case at all. The whole thing might have been unintentional. Actually, stealing someone else's idea is so common that it has a name: kleptomnesia. And the Beatle George Harrison lost a lot of money and mana because of it. His story opens an article on www.psychologytoday.com by Dr. Adam Grant, Wharton Professor of Management and Psychology, and the New York Times best-selling author of Give and Take, Why Helping Others Drives Our Success. Dr. Grant writes, all good things come to an end, and by 1970, the beloved Beatles had decided to go their separate ways. Within a year, George Harrison reached number one with a solo song, My Sweet Lord. But his sweet time at the top was short-lived. Within a month, a lawsuit was filed. Harrison's song had original lyrics, but shared a melody and harmony with the 1963 hit song by the Chiffons, "He's So Fine." Was the Beatles' lead guitarist guilty of plagiarism? Judge Richard Owen, who happened to be a music aficionado, ruled that Harrison was guilty. But he said Harrison's theft wasn't intentional. It was accidental and subconscious. Eventually, Harrison conceded that Owen was right. "I wasn't consciously aware of the similarity between He's So Fine and My Sweet Lord," Harrison wrote in his autobiography. "Why didn't I realize?" The psychologist Dan Gilbert calls this kleptomnesia, generating an idea that you believe is novel, but in fact was created by someone else. It's accidental plagiarism, and it's all too common in creative work. In a classic demonstration, psychologists Alan Brown and Dana Murphy invited people to brainstorm in groups of four. They took turns generating lists of sports, musical instruments, clothes, or four-legged animals. Each participant generated four ideas from each category. Next, the participants were asked to write down the four ideas that they personally generated for each category. Alarmingly, a full 75% of participants unintentionally plagiarized, claiming they generated an idea that was in fact offered by another member of their group. And later, the participants wrote down four new ideas for each category. The majority wrote down at least one idea that had already been generated by another group member, usually the group member who generated ideas immediately before them. Were they not paying attention? If so, then surely they'd have been just as likely to plagiarize from their own ideas. But that didn't happen. While 71% of participants took credit for an idea that a group member had generated, only 8% generated one of their own previous ideas. Dr. Grant says the kleptomnesia is due to an odd way that human memory is wired, and explains that we tend to pay more attention to the content than the source. When we take information to be true, we pay no more attention to where it came from. He says, "It's especially difficult to remember the source of information when we're busy, distracted, or working on a complex task." That sounds familiar in today's workplace. And the more our attention is divided, the less we notice who's responsible for the ideas that get raised. This explains why people are most likely to take credit for ideas generated immediately before their own. When it's almost their turn, they're maximally busy trying to come up with a good idea, so they never really pay attention to the source of the ideas that come right before their own. He says that psychologists say that to stop kleptomnesia, we should get rid of distractions and stop multitasking. And that sounds like mindfulness is in order here. He says it can also be useful to minimize exposure to similar work. For example, comedy writer George Meyer avoided watching Seinfeld while writing for The Simpsons, all 16 seasons of it. "I was afraid I might subconsciously borrow a joke," Meyer told me. Dr. Grant continues, "Had George Harrison taken these steps, he might have avoided a serious financial loss and heartbreak. At minimum, when generating ideas, it could be wise to identify a few existing ideas that are similar, scrutinize the overlap, and give credit where it's due. Otherwise, in Harrison's words, we all tend to break each other's hearts, taking and not giving back. In everyday life, the most important corrective action may involve training ourselves to focus not only on what was said, but also who said it." As the psychologists Neil McRae, Galen Bodenhausen, and Guglielmo Calvini put it, "May the source be with you." And then there's something called cryptomnesia, which is so close to kleptomnesia, it may as well be the same. It might sound like forgetfulness about vaults underneath churches, but actually refers to mistaking a memory for an original thought. It's also surprisingly common, and obviously can be the cause for someone unintentionally claiming something that didn't originally belong to them. Zaria Gorvit writes about this phenomenon on www.bbc.com in an article titled "Why Your Colleagues Can't Help Stealing Your Ideas." She writes, "When you start to think about it, the provenance of what you know is surprisingly hard to pin down. That's because there are, in fact, two kinds of long-term memory which can be consciously recalled. Let's say you attend a conference. While you're there, your brain will be busy updating the autobiographical record of your life, where you are and when, who's saying what, whether or not it's raining, a timeline of personal experiences one after another. This is your episodic memory. Then there's the actual content of the talks. While initially this is stored in the same place, eventually most general knowledge, facts, concepts, and meanings will be extracted and linked with similar knowledge in your semantic memory. This includes things such as capital cities and maths equations. This dual system makes recall a lot more efficient. And so you don't, for example, have to remember which teacher told you that Paris is the capital of France every time. But stripped of their original context, remembered ideas may have a false feeling of novelty. And if you do realize you've dredged up a suggestion from your last conference meeting, you're unlikely to remember who to credit. Once you start to see it, you'll find these innocent slip-ups happen disconcertingly often. There's that creeping self-awareness as you retell a joke to the person who made it up, or the galling moment you notice your eloquent argument was lifted word for word from an article you read that morning. It's not an uncommon phenomenon. Most of the time, we walk around with little bits of fiction sprinkled throughout our memories, and we don't even realize it, said Elizabeth Loftus, a psychologist at the University of Washington. So how common is cryptomnesia, and how can you tell when it's happening? There's no way to be sure, says Gorvit, but there are conditions in which cryptomnesia is more likely to occur. First, let's state the obvious. Good ideas are more likely to be stolen than bad ones. And studies have shown that not only is the quality of the idea important, also the credibility of who thought it up. She says we are more likely to find the colleague who stole our idea is the same gender as us. And cryptomnesia occurs more often in chaotic environments where it's harder to keep a record of who said what. She backs up the claim that we are likely to pilfer ideas from the person who participated directly before us, and not paying attention when collaborating with others can lead us to thinking we originated the idea. And that's where we must leave it for this week, as our time is now up. Thanks for being with the program today, and please tune in again next week. Please dedicate, as usual, to gaining enlightenment for the sake of all living beings. Thank you, and goodbye.
I need to know.